following is a record of my talk in Hackensack, New Jersey, on the theme, the Jewish psychology of marriage, or the psychology of Jewish marriage, on March 20th, 1963.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kleinerman, for that magnificent introduction. It's so hard to live up to it. Intellectually, I'm embarrassed by it. Emotionally, I relish it. However, I must offer the usual disclaimer and say that, on the contrary, it is I who am honored to have been invited by your distinguished rabbi to speak to you this evening. As a matter of fact, I'm going to have quite a bit of difficulty giving you in the next half an hour or so what he has just given you in 5 minutes about my subject. There's almost very little left to say if you take his remarks and expand them in principle. A great Jew once said the following: Shlosha heim nifla'u mimeni v'arba lo yedatim. Three things are too wonderful, they are mysterious for me, and four I cannot understand. And these three or four things are Derech Nesher Bashamayim, the way of an eagle in the heavens, modern interpretation, aeronautic principles. Derech Nochash Alei Tzur, the way of a serpent on a rock, modern interpretation, the principles of locomotion. Derech Aniya Belev Yam is the third, the way of a ship in the heart of the seas, the principles of navigation or commerce. And finally, the pièce de résistance, the really mysterious, wondrous, most obscure problem known to the writer of these lines, Derech Gever Bi'alma, the way of a man with a woman. In other words, the mystery of marriage. Now, the author of these lines is a man who was reputed to be the wisest of all men on the face of earth, King Solomon. And actually, this puts me at a great disadvantage, because if King Solomon, who was the wisest of all men in the whole world, and himself had 1,000 wives, didn't begin to know anything about marriage, then I, who am merely a humble monogamist and have only one wife, how can I know much about it and tell it to you yet? Nevertheless, this is the task that I have, to try to analyze with you, in the brief time allotted to us, some Jewish insights into the psychology of marriage as Judaism and Torah have understood it throughout the ages. Jewish marriage can, of course, be analyzed in many aspects. There is the legal aspect, which deals primarily with the ways that the Bible and the rabbis devised for the protection of the woman in what once was primarily a man's society. It's possible to discuss Jewish marriage sociologically. It's possible to discuss it from a cultural point of view, anthropologically. But we tonight have chosen the psychological approach, and especially the psychological approach to Jewish marriage. I'm not going to speak about marriage in the ordinary terms you would expect perhaps of a marriage counselor. Since we are going to speak of the psychology involved, then our discussion will have to be largely based upon psychological problems. And in marriage, psychological problems are mostly, though not completely by any means, sexual in nature. And therefore, what we will want to understand, above all, is the Jewish attitudes towards sex. Because in a larger sense, this means the Jewish attitude towards the human mind, the human body, and the human personality. Judaism has always understood that the sexual element is of the essence of marriage, of the very essence of it. Despite the fact that Jews, traditional Jews, and Judaism have always maintained reserve, dignity, tzniyus, modesty, nevertheless, this has never meant prudishness. There has always been frankness as long as it was accompanied by a sense of reverence for human beings, for the human body, and for the human emotions. That's why the rabbi said that Hako Yodin Kala Lama Nichnasa L'Chupa. Everyone knows why people get married. Nevertheless, if one is a guest at a wedding, Kol Hamanaveil Piv, and utters an indecent word, an obscene thought, then even if he has lived 70 years in complete piety and purity, then immediately heaven decrees that he shall be cut off from all eternity. So that you see, at the same time, a complete frankness on the part of traditional Judaism, this is a Talmudic statement, and at the same time, a sense of reverence, of respect, and utter dignity. The recognition of the importance of the physical element in marriage is stipulated by the rabbis, or in fact, not by the rabbis, by the Bible, when it declares that one of the three rights of a woman in marriage, one of the three responsibilities of the husband, the three major ones, is she'era k'susa v'onasa, to provide his wife with food, with clothing, and with conjugal rights. Ona is the rights of marriage, the physical ones. And incidentally, the very fact that Judaism regarded ona, the conjugal rights, as a woman's claim, as a woman's privilege, means that Judaism was far more advanced in its sexology than even the most modern writers are wont to be. Many of us who study the contemporary tracts on the problems of sex and marriage in modern days are sometimes led to believe that consideration for the feelings of the woman, consideration for her personality and her rights in marriage, is a modern invention that have come about only since the so-called emancipation of women in the last, well, shall we say, 50 or 100 years. But it's really not so. The fact is that Judaism has maintained this for ages past. It has recognized that the sexual is not the private domain of the husband, but it is as much the interest and concern of the wife in the deepest recesses of her heart, her psyche, and her mind. For that matter, it may be astounding to those who are acquainted with this kind of literature that there was a book published in the Middle Ages, a little booklet called Igeres HaKodesh, which means the Holy Letter, or the Letter of Holiness. This was attributed to a great scholar called the Ramban, or Nachmanides. Actually, it was written by a very famous mystic or Kabbalist of the Middle Ages by the name of Rabbi Azriel ibn Gakatila, a Sephardic scholar. Now, what is this Epistle of Holiness? It's essentially, well, one of those modern, up-to-date books on marriage, that marriage manuals that you might buy today from a team that consists of a psychiatrist, a marriage counselor, a gynecologist, a doctor, and all the zibben glicken, and they finally manage to emerge with some kind of judgment on marriage. And here in this little booklet, published some 700-800 years ago, you have an insight into marriage and into a consideration for the woman's feelings, desires, and wants that is as advanced as the latest textbook you can find of this nature. So that if this is the case, we see that Judaism in its whole approach was never prudish. It maintained that the sexual functions of human beings are perfectly natural. Now, a natural function can be bad. The sexual function can mostly be misused. Ein apotropos la'arayas. It is the most powerful instinct that we have. And because it can be misused, therefore Judaism is extremely strict against any kind of licentiousness. Therefore the principle of tznius, or modesty, is extremely important in Jewish life. As a matter of fact, by default, unfortunately, we have allowed the Jewish principles and standards of tznius, of modesty, to fall by the wayside. And sometimes I'm ashamed of our fellow Jews and our sister Jewesses. I know that no right-thinking woman in her right mind would walk into a Catholic church in the kind of clothing or lack of them with which some women walk into a synagogue, whether it be for a wedding or for a service or for anything else. There is no excuse for a Jewish woman to act without tznius, without modesty, when people of other faiths who have learned these principles from us still practice them in the fullest extent. Nevertheless, these are Jewish principles. Judaism, in its pristine sense, in its traditional sense, would react with nothing less than nausea to the kind of, the kind of demonstrativeness that we give to the human body nowadays, where every advertisement, from soap to toothpaste to automobiles to locomotives to gasoline, has to be accompanied by some kind of reference to sex, which will never fail somehow to be aimed at exciting somebody. It's not ridiculous. From the Jewish point of view, it's obscene. From this point of view, therefore, Judaism is highly strict. And yet at the same time, that it recognized that there must be tznius, there must be modesty, there must be restraint, there must be reserve, there must be dignity. At the same time, Judaism never took the attitude that sex is dirty. As a matter of fact, Judaism knows that in biblical law, there are 613 commandments, which is the very first commandment. Pruravu, be fruitful and multiply. Therefore, the law for procreation, or the law of sex, is the first mitzvah in the whole Torah. Under the chuppah, 7 blessings are recited. And amongst these blessings, we thank God and praise Him for having created man as He did. We thank God for making the chosan and the kala happy with each other. In other words, our attitude is that when dealt with legitimately, when channeled properly, according to Torah, according to the insights of the Jewish spirit, according to the dictates of God as recorded in our holy tradition, then it is an occasion for joy, for simcha, an occasion for personal bliss. Of course, it must be understood, when I emphasize the fact that Judaism recognizes that sex is a major element, the major element of marriage, by no means do I want anyone to go away thinking that I said it's the only thing that really matters. This is a horrid exaggeration of modern literature. Sometimes, and I'm sure your rabbi would agree with me, we have to counsel young couples. People want to get married. What literature do you give them? I must tell you, there's almost nothing you can give them. Because if you finally do get a book that's halfway decent, when it deals with the sexual aspects of marriage, and they are so rare, so far in between, I don't think there is a really good one. It's so over-emphatic in dealing with this element that you'd imagine that nothing else counts. And so young people have to be told that money counts, and the problems of deciding a family budget are a great source of irritation, and have to be formulated in advance, if possible. In-laws are a great source of friction, usually, incidentally, more because young people imagine things, imagine insults, imagine competition than really exists. But there are many areas of difficulty for young people, for young couples. So this certainly is not the only one. And on the other hand, in addition to the fact Now let me give you examples of how other matters can contribute to happiness in marriage from the Jewish tradition. The Jewish tradition maintains that God created Chava, Eve, for Adam, Ezer Kenegdo. Ezer Kenegdo literally means a help against him. So the rabbi said, if he is worthy, she is an Ezer, she's a helpmate. If he is not worthy, Kenegdo, she's always against him. Now there are many ways to make sure that husband and wife are helpful to each other and not against one another. Maimonides, for instance, declares that the famous commandment, V'yahavta l'reicha kamocha, thou shalt love thy, not thy neighbor, but thy fellow man as thyself, refers to one's wife above all. That to have feelings of profound affection and love for one's own spouse is the very first commandment of V'yahavta l'reicha kamocha. Charity begins at home. You know the word charity is the Greek for love. It should begin at home. Or Maimonides also decides in a famous passage, how was one happy on Yontif? You know that on Yontif, on the holiday, there's a mitzvah to be happy. V'samachta b'chagecha. How is one happy? Well, there are various levels. One of them is to offer up the korban chagiga, the special sacrifice. Another one is to eat meat and drink wine. You make kiddush on Yontif. There's another one, says the Rambam, and that is to buy clothes and fur coats for your wife. So any ladies in the audience who are having problems with their husbands insofar as getting that mink you've long been waiting for can quote Maimonides to the effect that for Pesach, at the latest first Shavuos, it has to be yours. I never told my wife this law, incidentally. And yet, despite the significance of so many other aspects, in this very complex relationship called marriage, there is no doubt that the one we have been discussing is quite important. Now, there's something that troubles me. Rabbi Kleinemann referred to it in his introduction. When we speak to young couples, and I'm sure I speak for him too, we always let them know what they're facing. To let them go into marriage without any understanding of the problematica involved would be to forfeit what essentially is our duty. We have to tell them that the divorce rate in America sometimes goes as high as 1 out of 3. And if 1 out of 3 couples end up in the divorce courts, you just figure out how many don't because they live in states where they can't, because of social pressure, because of children, because it's too expensive. Then figure of those who never come to it because they're not that miserable, but they're sufficiently miserable, well, just to be unhappy throughout the rest of their lives. And you discover that the really happy couple is the exception rather than the rule. And those of us who deal with human beings professionally, as rabbis, as doctors, as psychologists, as counselors, we know that people who otherwise may appear to be perfectly normal and happy, in the depths of their heart and in their homes, when the doors are closed, are deeply unhappy, and sometimes they reveal that unhappiness to us. That's why we always tell young people that they never should expect that they'll fall into happiness accidentally. You don't do that. And when I refer to young couples, I'm just speaking, you know, with the Yiddish expression, mezoktem shver memeintem edem. You speak to your husband and you mean your son-in-law. I'm referring not only to young couples, I'm referring to all married couples. But the fact is that happiness is never achieved behesach hadas, accidentally, mindlessly, thoughtlessly. It's got to be worked at. And if this is not going to be worked out, what's more important in life? Because if the home isn't happy, there is very little other area in life where one can find real happiness. So what troubles us is this. The question is, why should there be this much unhappiness amongst Jews nowadays? Why should it be increasing? Especially in view of the fact that the Jewish home has always been the paragon of shalom bayis, of domestic peace. Jews never were demonstrative. These words that we use of endearment nowadays so freely, darling, dear, sweetheart, We use them ad nauseum until they're meaningless, they're empty of all content. Our grandparents never used them. They never showed their love in public. Nevertheless, it was a rare home where there was a divorce, although divorce in Judaism has no stigma to it, and it's the easiest thing to get. Just as two parties can agree to get married, two parties can agree to a divorce, and no judge can stop them. Happy homes were the rule in Jewish life. They were specifically the rule in Orthodox Jewish life. A Reform rabbi in Cincinnati about 7 or 8 years ago wrote a book on Jewish marriage. And in it he writes that as Jewish couples have left the rubric of Jewish life, as they have departed from tradition, from Orthodox tradition, from observance of the Torah and the mitzvahs in their wholesomeness, then the statistics regarding marriage and divorce, regarding promiscuity and philandering, regarding alcoholism, have tended to shade off into what is normal for the rest of the population. And so it becomes a real problem into why it is and how it can be avoided. And to my mind, there are a number of answers that are terribly important. And they refer to a number of the things we have begun to mention. Number one is the Jewish home. There must be a re-emphasis on the home, a conscious one by father, mother, and children. What has happened is that the focus of our activities has been shifted from the home to the community center, to the office, to the golf club, to visiting, everything but the home. You know the story of the woman who was approached by a young woman was approached by a real estate dealer. Called her up and introduced himself, said, "I'm a real estate dealer." She said, "What do you want?" She said, "I want to sell you a house." She said, "What?" She said, "I want to sell you a house, a home." She said, "Look, mister, I was born in a maternity ward. I was raised in a nursery. I spent the rest of my life in school. My vacations I had in a hotel. When I have other vacations, I go in the stateroom on a cruise. When I get sick, I'm in a hospital. And when I die, it's from a funeral chapel. Who needs a home? Who needs a home anymore? We have everything. Who needs a home? We have learned to live beyond the home to the point where the home has become emptied. Once upon a time, parents and children met in a home. The family unit was forged in a home. The table, the shulchan, was the most important place of a home. Children did their homework there. Husband and wife discussed their problems there. Grandparents were in a home, and that was so terribly important for letting children feel a sense of continuity and giving weight and anchorage to a home. But we have forgotten it, and therefore, number one is we are required to reestablish the home as the center of our lives. But let me come now to an even more basic element. It is what I have been referring to all along, the sexual element. In order to appreciate the judgment of Judaism and the divine wisdom within the Jewish tradition by which it has devised a way for the psychological happiness and spiritual integrity of two people cannot be discussed in a vacuum. It has to be discussed from the point of view of certain specific Jewish institutions. Now, these Jewish institutions, which I now am going to mention, are very little understood, less appreciated, and even less practiced. Some of you may know what I'm going to talk about. Others may not. Likely, there are some people who have heard it in the context of the occasion for a good off-color joke, which is unfortunate and tragic because that means that you have heard demeaned one of the noblest institutions of all religions that ever existed on the face of earth. I am referring to those laws which are known generally as Taharas HaMishpacha, family purity, which I would suspect, together with Shabbos and Kashrus, this Taharas HaMishpacha, family purity, together with Shabbos and Kashrus, are the three greatest institutions of Judaism. Taharas HaMishpacha means that during the monthly cycle, during the time of the menses, and for a period of a week following, there must be no relations between husband and wife. At the end of this time, the wife must perform the ritual of immersion in a bath of living waters, what is called a mikvah. Mikvah means to gather together. This is where the Christians get their baptism from. The mikvah is a body of water in which a person was required to immerse himself or herself. Before the days of the destruction of the temple, there were many kinds of reasons why a person, both man and woman, should avail himself of the services of a mikvah. After the Christians departed from Judaism, they kept up the mikvah. That's why John the Baptist, baptism meant he immersed himself in a mikvah as a means of purification. But later on, the institution changed in Christianity to the point where the priest would take a few drops of water and sprinkle it. So this baptism of the Christians goes back to the biblical institution, which we keep up in the form of mikvah. So that basically the law is that during this special biological period of the rhythm of life, there should be no relations. And then there is reunion and normal marital relations resume once again. This is the essential law. It's a complex part of Jewish law. It's a terribly important part. The fact that it is not very widely observed does not mean that it's not terribly important. You know that honesty is very important? Yet how many of us are utterly honest? 100%. When it comes to law and to principle, numbers never determine validity or importance. As a matter of fact, there has been a recrudescence, a regrowth, a renewed interest in various parts of the country in this particular Jewish institution, which means so very much in the intimate life of human beings, of Jews. Nevertheless, there are a few people, and it's only a few. Not because it's a few, not because people have tried it and found that it's not for them, but because it hasn't been tried. You know the story of the Shammas who was standing in front of his shul. There were only 9 people for a minyan. And he was very interested in getting a minyan. It was late for mincha. So he saw a young fellow passing in a hurry, well-dressed, obviously Jewish. The Shammas said, "Younger man, come, I want to have you for a 10th man." And so he said, "What do you want?" He said, "I want to come in and we have to daven mincha." He says, the young man was in a hurry, and he said to him, "Look, mister," he said, "I'm very sorry that I can't come because I'm on my way to do a business deal. And whenever I daven mincha, I lose the deal." He said, "I'm sorry, whenever I don't daven mincha, I have a good deal. Whenever I miss mincha, I make out well." So the Shammas thought, he said, "Well, very good, but tell me, what happens when you do daven mincha?" He said, "I'll tell you the truth, I never tried it." The same thing is true with this particular area of Jewish life. It's tremendously important. And you can't appreciate it until you've lived a Jewish life based on it. Just as you can't appreciate Shabbos until you've observed Shabbos. All the talking in the world will give you the superstructure. But the experience of a real Shabbos cannot be gotten except by living it. And the same thing is true of living a life sanctified by Taras and Mishpacha. Why is it important? Why did Judaism put so much into it? Essentially, of course, it's a law, and the law, if it's a divine law as we believe it is, you don't question it. But nevertheless, we're allowed to plumb its depths and try to discover its values. What are some of the values? Now, essentially, there's one principle that goes through, but I see it in 3 levels. And let me try to explain it to you. The first thing it does is remove from us the psychological impression, the prejudice, the bogus, and the bias that almost all of us have inwardly, that the whole business is somewhat dirty. You know, we live in a post-Freudian age, and we're all sophisticated. We all talk fancy language, we're all liberated, we're all emancipated, and we know that it's not really a dirty thing. And yet, the very society we live in raises us to talk a good line of being emancipated and sophisticated, and inwardly to have the feeling that there's something terribly wrong, something guilty about the whole enterprise called sex. You know where it comes from? It comes from our Christian environment. Because Christianity has a heavy, heavy heritage of guilt about the sexual part of personality. It stems specifically from the founder of Christianity, a man by the name of Paul, the real founder of Christianity. He was very much opposed to any kind of indulgence in sex. He told his followers, better stay unmarried, but if you feel you must, then I give you permission to get married. What was their idea? That the devil resides in the flesh. That the whole business is something which is a concession. At most, marriage is a concession by God. But it is best to remain celibate, to remain single, and not to have any kind of experience, as we Jews believe the reverse. Our opinion is that it's not so. Our belief has been that, as I mentioned before, this is a creation of God, and that's what we say under the chuppah. We make a blessing, Asher Yosar Asa Adam B'Tzalmo. God created man this way. It's a divine way. Therefore, immediately before the reunion, the monthly reunion between husband and wife, there is always the, as I mentioned, the ritual, the mitzvah of mikveh, the washing away, the purification in water, which even if we come to marriage and to the whole procedure of marriage throughout life with the inner feeling that there is something terrible about it, there's something guilty, something off color about sexual relationships, then the whole experience of mikveh teaches us the judgment of Judaism, of Torah, namely, that if it is done legitimately, if it is within the confines of marriage, if it is done according to Din Torah, according to the law of Torah, then it's something of superb and supreme and supernal beauty. Then the wife makes a bracha, Asher kedeshanu b'mitzvosa v'tzivonu al mitzvas tefila, and the husband is rewarded for his restraint by the knowledge that this kind of relationship is divinely blessed and divinely approved, that it's mitzvah. Not only isn't it bad, but it's positively a virtue in the eyes of morality, in the eyes of religion, in the eyes of faith. The same idea, of course, is Neros Shabbos, the Sabbath candles. When a woman puts on Friday night lights, her Friday night candles, why? Why was the mitzvah given to a woman? Because the pure light of the candle symbolizes shalom bayis, peace of the home. That the home life is something of great nobility, it's lofty, it's beautiful, it's clear. And therefore, the Sabbath candles are kindled by the wife to give the romantic element to the home. Yes, a romantic element, plain and simple. Because this is something beautiful, and Shabbos, the holiest day of the week, which is the reason for the creation of heaven and earth, you know, Ata Gedashtus Yom HaShvi, Tachlis Maaseh Shemayim V'Aretz, the purpose of the world, according to tradition, was the enjoyment of the Shabbos. The Shabbos is incomplete without the romantic element, the romance between husband and wife. So that the first rationale of mikveh is to give us, by actual practice, that psychological reinforcement to know that we are indulging in something holy when we proceed in the marriage act. Second, it's been my experience, as it has been the experience of innumerable people who deal with such problems, that shortly after marriage, the young woman will appear in tears and her distraught husband limply following her. And they have problems and complaints. They're unhappy. And then some words will slip from the young wife's mouth. She'll say, Rabbi, I'm deeply distressed because the honeymoon is already over. Now, it's only an idiomatic expression, isn't it? We talk about politicians, presidents, and Congress, the honeymoon is over. A rabbi with his congregation, the honeymoon is over. You're in a new job, the honeymoon is over. You have a new boss, a new employee, a new partner. The beginning is good, and the honeymoon is over. But in this case, the tragedy is that the honeymoon is over. And from the Jewish point of view, the honeymoon must never be over. From the Jewish point of view, a marriage is really a marriage only if the honeymoon lasts forever. And how does it last forever according to Judaism? How does Judaism manage it? That a couple can get married and the honeymoon continues. Do you know how? Through this regimen I've been describing to you. Because what does the honeymoon mean? It means first there is a period where a young man and a young woman know each other. They're engaged. They're committed to each other. But they're separate. They are separate. And in the course of their separation, there is a yearning for each other. And they wait and they set a marriage date. The marriage is preceded, again, by the purification of mikveh. And then on the marriage night, they meet. So the analysis of the concept of honeymoon means to know each other, to love each other, to be separate, and then to come together. Now, what the whole regimen and routine of Taharas HaMishpacha does is to say to a young woman that all your girlhood dreams are not going to be consummated and over with the first month you're married, and then it's done. But that the whole beauty, the whole ceremony, the whole ritual, which is so dramatic, so romantic, and so beautiful, of being separate and then coming together, this waiting for each other, this longing for each other, is repeated throughout life. Every month is a honeymoon for a Jewish couple that practices Taharas HaMishpacha. And this is a profound psychological insight. It means that every month, during the course of the period that the woman is unwell and for a week afterwards, there is separation. There is talking, of course. There is conversation. But physical separation. And then, as with a young kala, as with a young bride, there is the ceremony of mikveh every month, and then the reunion, which means remarrying, essentially. The whole ceremony, the whole drama, and all its psychological integrity and all its psychological loveliness is repeated once again. So that, as a result, the marriage act never becomes prosaic. It never becomes, as it so easily can, an animal act. Something which is purely biological, but which lacks spiritual grace, which lacks an engagement of personalities as well as of bodies. It never becomes vachidik. It never becomes weekdayish and second nature. It never becomes habit and routine. Because of this enforced period of separation, where husband and wife know that they may not approach each other even if they should so desire, this very fact means that love, even beyond the sexual, has a chance to emerge. Because there is a period when sex is beyond consideration, but when true generosity, kindliness, loveliness, simply considerateness of one for the other can be demonstrated without the physical element entering into the picture. So that here is a chance for love, and I hate to use that word incidentally. Do you know why? Because in our society, it's become so cheap that every high school boy who's thinking of giving a pin to a girl he's going to study with, who probably is 12 years old, thinks he's in love. The word has become Pulp magazine product. It's the cheapest commodity we have. So that if I use it, I don't use it in that sense at all. I mean it in this profoundest sense of two human beings totally committed to each other. Without being superhuman, but totally committed to each other. And with a profound liking and respect. And that word is very, very important. Profound respect for each other. Finally, the whole institution makes human beings out of people who otherwise could degenerate into something less. I'll tell you why. There's a certain philosopher who has popularized two expressions in modern life. The words are it and thou. Thou, the singular you. It is possible to treat another individual as an it, as an object, as something that is a means for my end, or as a thou, as a human being in the full splendor of personality. When I treat another person as only a pawn on a chessboard, I manipulate him. I don't care who he is. I look right through him. As far as I'm concerned, I don't give a darn about him. His personality is of no interest. But I'll flatter him. I'll compliment him, I'll be sweet to him, because I have to use that fellow. Then he's an it. But if I talk to him seriously, and I say nice things to him because I mean it, and I criticize him because I mean it, and I'm very involved in his life, and I'm concerned that things should go well with him, if I have a respect for a personality, and he is an end in himself, not just a means to my end, I don't manipulate him, I treat him as an equal to me, then he is a thou, a human being. Now, in marriage, it is very easy for a wife to become an it instead of a thou to her husband. It's very easy, because of the whole nature of marriage as such, for a husband to consider a wife a means to the satisfaction of his own wants and nothing more. It's perfectly natural. There is something of the caveman in every human being which we hark back to our primitive origins. And yet, if a man is going to be a human being, human with a sense of being touched by a spiritual delicacy, then he has to learn to treat every human being, and especially his own wife, as a full personality, at least his own equal, if not more. And here is where the whole splendor of the Jewish tradition reveals itself. It tells a husband that the woman you have married is not at your beck and call whenever you so wish. That there are times when it's even beyond her consent. There are times that the Torah itself, the Rabbonu Shel Olam, God, interposes and says to a husband and wife, not now. You must wait until the appropriate time. And therefore you must learn that this woman is a human being with inalienable rights to the welfare of her own mind, the integrity of her own sensitivity, and the delicacy of her own feelings, her heart, her soul, her neshama. By doing this, our husband learns to have a sense of equality. And that's why the whole issue of the equality of the woman never arose in Jewish life, and when it did, the whole issue was false. The whole issue is false. In the traditional Jewish synagogue, there never was a problem of the equality of women. Because as long as the Jewish family practiced the Haras HaMishpacha, what woman ever felt that she wasn't equal to her husband? If her most intimate rights were protected by a 3,000-year-old tradition, if she felt that she was a personality created in the image of God and her husband recognized it, that she didn't have to make a spiel and shul and have an aliyah, as some of our other friends arrange it, in order to prove her equality. There was no reason for it, because she was just as equal as anyone else, if not more so. Well, I've talked at some length. I think I'm just within the time limit that your rabbi set for me, to say that I've barely touched the surface of the subject needn't be said. Because we are dealing with, as I said before, one of the most complex, profound, and, as Solomon said, mysterious relationships. But Judaism has, through its various institutions, especially through Taharas HaMishpacha, given us a most unusual, modern, up-to-date insight into the psychology of husband and wife, and the psychology of Jewish marriage. And therefore, with the observance of these principles of Jewish family purity, with the observance of the Friday night candles, and all else that goes into making a Jewish home, and with all that it symbolizes, love, purity, chastity, fidelity, generosity, and mutual respect, with these, they represent that wonderful and beholden, that golden ideal, always cherished by Judaism, that of shalom bayis, domestic peace, tranquility, and joy. Well, that's a good democratic statement, except that when you drive democracy to the bitter end, you find that you lose more than you gain. You know the famous story of the French Parliament, Vive la France, when the suffragettes said, who are fighting for women's rights, that after all, qu'est-ce que sont, what are the differences between men and women? And the whole parliament arose as one man and said, vive les différences, long live the differences. What I mean is this, and this has been pointed out by a man who is known in anthropology as being a very staunch advocate of women's superiority, not equality, but superiority biologically. And that man is Professor Ashley Montague of Columbia University. He and a number of other writers have made a very important point to which I think Judaism would subscribe completely. And that is that there is a difference between value and function. Men and women have the same value, utterly equal. They do not have the same function. No matter how much democracy you have, no man will ever be accepted in the maternity wards. The very biological differences between men and women, their psychological differences, their whole personality makeup, means that there have to be different roles for men and women. Now, there are certain times when we can experiment with these roles. There may have been times when it was thought that a woman can't be a doctor or can't be a scientist. We know that to be false. Society permits itself a certain experimentation until it gets a balance. But when we take an extremist, dogmatic, doctrinaire point of view, equality across the board, we run several very severe risks. And what are these risks? It means that we begin to confuse the role of man and woman. Now, one chap, I think his name is Coughlin, who is quite a well-known and good science writer, especially for the social and behavioral sciences, has pointed out that part of the reason for the psychological breakdown in modern contemporary America is that the growing boy and growing girl have lost sight of the role they are to play in society. He calls this the great problem of sexual ambiguity. In other words, once upon a time, the boy knew that his job in society was to take over certain manly functions. But today's little boy sees his mother and his aunts and his neighbors taking over some of those same functions. He sees in the course of society, I'm not coming out against anything or for anything, just to give you examples. In traditional society, a woman didn't smoke, nor did she wear pants, nor did she engage in activities which men perhaps more normally engage in. She didn't drink in public. Today, women do. Men, once upon a time, paved the roads, they dug ditches, they were the tailors, and they didn't often wash the diapers and dishes, at least never to be seen by a neighbor or in public. Today, a growing child is not quite certain what his role is in life. The little girl is not certain, should she really play cops and robbers, or should she play dollhouse with the dolls and play house? The whole problem has become one of not knowing our own identity. Now, we Jews maintain that in value there is equality, but that does not mean that there is, not equality, the word equality is irrelevant, that there is identity of function. There must be separation of function. As long as a man is biologically and psychologically a man and a woman is biologically and psychologically a woman, there's going to be a difference. Then I didn't hear it. Give me examples.
Well, for example, must you be of the male sex in order to be seen equally in the sight of God, to go up on the bema and be given an aliyah and pray to your God on the very same level as a man? Because when you must admit that ours is a society that is definitely patriarchal, and it says that the man is superior. This is
no. When you say it's patriarchal, I agree. When you say that it says man is superior, I challenge you to say where it says so.
Well, the mere fact
a patriarchal society, excuse me, does not mean superiority. It means that the function, the public function, the function of heading the family has always, in our society, a patriarchal society, belongs to the father. That does not mean there is no equality. It means there is different functions. In my house, we have a patriarchal family unit. My wife does not feel inferior because when it comes to certain things, there we discuss things and I have the last word. When it comes to certain matters of the house, I would suggest I would never dare interfere. It does not mean inequality. It means separation of function only. Very good. Good, I'll explain it to you. I'm going to state your question clearly so we have no mistake. Why can't a woman be seen clearly in the sight of God and offer up a prayer without an intermediary? First, let me tell you that God, blessed be his name, can see beyond the mechitza. Even if the woman does not come up to the bima, the Almighty Lord, in his greatness, benevolence, and omnipotence, can see a woman and hear her prayer if it is offered devoutly. So that the reason for coming up on the bima is not to be seen in the eyes of God. And I should hope that the demand for a woman to come up on the bima is not that she be seen in the eyes of the congregation. Because this specifically is the problem. Now, I'm not saying that this is the woman, those who are fighting to have a woman get aliyahs is because they want to introduce a new chapter into Vogue, you know, the right dress to wear when you get an aliyah. I'm not referring to that. That would be perhaps a bit, ungallant of me. I'm not doing that. I'm not even suggesting it. I do say that this is the reason that the tradition has said that a woman should not get an aliyah. Mind you, a woman is as precious in the eyes of God, as I said before, as is a man. Religiously, there is no question of equality. As a matter of fact, one of the main reasons that a woman is relieved of obligations in certain mitzvos, certain commandments, is because of the mikveh. I can't go into it now. Or, do I have a few moments yet? Let me go into it. It's a rather philosophic idea. I'll come back to your specific question in a moment. But let me show you the relationship. I want to prove that the question is relevant. Otherwise, maybe both of us are out of order. Judaism declares that, you see, in Judaism we have a whole group of commandments, mitzvos. Some are positive, some are negative. What are our positive commandments? Examples. Shofar, Shabbos, to make Kiddush and Shabbos, Lulav, anything else? The fast and Yom Kippur, to give charity, positive. What are some of the negative commandments? Don't murder, don't steal, don't work on Shabbos. What else? Anyone? Negative commandment, somebody? Not to speak evilly of your neighbor, not to gossip. The most difficult to observe, of course. With the invention of the modern telephone, the whole mitzvah has gone into the by the wayside. Positive and negative. Now, a woman, like a man, is required to observe all the negative commandments, without exception. When it comes to the positive commandments, here Jewish law distinguishes. It says, those commandments, positive commandments, which are time-geared, which are conditioned by time element, a woman need not observe. Which means any mitzvah, which you observe only at certain times, not at other times, then technically speaking, a woman need not observe. Which means that tefillin can be put on only during the day, not at night. Therefore, a woman need not put on tefillin. The reading of the Torah is done Mondays, Thursdays, and Shabbos. Time conditioned, a woman is free from the obligation. Tzitzis, only during the day, a woman is free from the obligation. Shofar, only during Rosh Hashanah, a woman technically need not hear the shofar. They have developed a custom, because it's such a beautiful ceremony, of listening to it. But technically speaking, if she missed the shofar, the woman has committed no sin at all. A man has. So that, this is the point, mitzvahs aseh, a positive commandment, shehazman grama, which is time conditioned, a woman is free. Why? Many reasons. Let me give you a reason different from the one you probably heard if you heard it. And that relates to what I said before. Why should men, after all, be obligated to observe these mitzvahs? What is different, after all, about a positive commandment that is time conditioned? You know what's different about it? A mitzvah of this sort makes a human being aware of the holiness of time itself. A man who knows that in the morning I get up and I have to put on my tefillin, somehow he connects dawn, the beginning of day, with a devotion to God. He's aware that time is holy. It has kedusha. It has something to it. It's sacred. If he knows that once a week he must make kiddush, that act of making kiddush means that the cycle of time has meaning. Otherwise, all of time is one endless drudgery, monotonous, that goes on and on without any interruption. It has no meaning, no periodicity to it, no beauty to it, and therefore no sanctity. By the mitzvahs aseisha hazman grama, these time mitzvahs, he knows that at certain times he does certain things, he becomes aware externally.